Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, episode 9.
Excellent prep work.
In which we talk with Christian Robinson. I'm Chet Haas from the Android Framework team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team. And today we have...
Christian Robertson from the Android Visual Design group.
Visual Design, what are we doing? What? We're going to talk about... Or can we talk about code anyway?
Sure.
Actually, the designers I've met at Google are very interesting because I think everybody at Google is highly technical. So I think the first time I actually talked to you, you were hacking on some like private project on some font-related thing. And a lot of the other designers, they're like, you know, hacking whatever plug-in code for design tools and stuff. So
yeah, I like working at Google because I feel like that visual design is like my entry pass to get to come and hang out with really cool engineers.
And us.
And us. Yes.
So let's figure out what we're actually talking about today. So some of the stuff that that you are known for, I think probably the most public-facing thing is the Roboto font. So why don't we start there?
Yeah.
So fonts in general, your interest in fonts, why Roboto? What's happening with it?
Yeah, so I like fonts. it's maybe a compulsion.
They're character building.
Yes, character building. No, I think I made my first font when I was in the fifth grade.
Was it one of those graffiti fonts, you know, with a 3D under it? Like the stuff you would see on, you know, railway stations and things, subways?
A little bit. It was titled Christian. I figured out how to use the ResEdit app in my old Mac to make a font. So about Roboto, though, when we were first thinking about a new type for Android, we wanted something that could be a really hard-working font that wouldn't really get in the way and make you think about it too hard while you're reading it. You shouldn't be thinking about, you know, details in the typeface while you're reading. But at the same time, we wanted to find a couple places to add some personality and character. And so there are a few kind of secret little bits in there.
Emojis.
No, we have some emoji fonts, but not inside.
So you have to, like, really scale up the font to look for these little watermarks that says Christian?
Yeah.
People have wondered why it's actually a font file that's 7 gigs large.
Yeah, you know that semicolon, the comma, is actually his name just compressed on the bottom.
I'm not going to say anything.
So I remember at the time that we came out with Roboto, was it Honeycomb?
It was ice cream sandwich.
ICS. Yep. One of the things that scared me is whenever you touch anything like fonts, you're going to touch metrics, which is going to affect basically everything. Everything on the UI is going to change slightly in response to the metrics that you just changed, right? So strings are going to be slightly narrower or wider, or they're not going to be as high, or your descent is going to be greater. So that was certainly my fear. Was it well-founded, or did we have issues when we were sort of plugging it together and making the release actually ship, where, you know, buttons then go on to the next line or whatever?
Yeah, so anytime that you don't have metrics that are exactly the same, you'll have different line breaks. It wasn't as big of a problem as we might have expected, just because as we design these things, we really make sure that it works for internationalization. And, you know, the tolerances there are pretty wide. So we did make sure that the vertical metrics were the same, though, so that we wouldn't have things moving around up and down. But laterally, you always want to make sure that you have, I think the rule that we use is another almost third the length of a string in order to, from the English string to make sure we have enough space for internationalization.
I thought I read somewhere that on average German is 40% wider than English. Maybe I totally misread
all the bratwurst.
But it sounds like that third is going to be just slightly off for Germans.
That's the absolute minimum. So that,
yeah.
You know,
oh, I see.
In really pinchy places,
yeah.
You know, we might have to use some other techniques.
So speaking of internationalization, whenever I look at Unicode, I realize there's so many different pages and characters. How complete is Roboto? Like, is it have you done lots of character sets other than, you know, English?
Yeah.
Like, so is there a Thai version of Roboto?
No. So we use a variety of font files in Android to cover different languages. We want to make sure that we have a set of types that work well together and look good together. We have some fallback fonts for.
I see. So if a language is missing, we'll pick some other font that is same in character. Like, it's not going to be cursive or something, right? It's going to be Roboto-like, but whatever.
Yeah. Right now, Roboto covers, I'll call them the Phoenician languages, which covers
Finland, Phoenicia, the Phoenician Empire.
Yeah, not the Phoenician alphabet itself, but the languages or the character sets that come from that. So Greek and Cyrillic and Roman, and the languages that use those are covered by Roboto.
Dead languages, then. Is that what you're saying? Dead, non-spoken language. Well, it's a written...
I think Greek is probably still in somewhat use in some countries, like Greece.
Although there is a difference between classical... Is it the classical Greek, or is it the current spoken Greek?
The current spoken... The classical Greek has another set of characters that aren't in Roboto.
All right. Roboto V7. Speaking of versions, so there have been enhancements to Roboto or other versions that have come out since the original one. Like, what? So what's the impetus then to introduce, you know, other variations on that? Or was it always the plan, like, well, we got the basics in, you know, we got plain in the first release, and then we'll build on that?
Well, you added light or something like that, right? Or condensed. There was some new Roboto font in API 17, I thought.
Yeah, so we've been adding more weights to the platform so that we can have more expression available for typographers to use various weights.
Do you have guidelines for when people should use different ones, or is it just what feels good?
Yeah, so we have guidelines for the kind of basic text styles. One of the guidelines is to think about for your app, where are the places where you can be expressive and do something unique? So I think those are the places where you really want app designers to design something new, something exciting. So we're giving people tools to express things that we didn't necessarily plan for.
So if you're a developer listening to this podcast and you don't really have UI skills, are you better off just doing what the theme gives you by default, or should you pick Comic Sans for everything because that looks cool?
Well, you have to make sure that you get the license for Comic Sans, and then you can use it. It really depends on the app exactly what you should be doing. There are some games where it really makes sense to have a really thematic type. Comic Sans, and there are a lot of places where, you know, the basic theme really works, and you know, it doesn't really make sense.
So there aren't things like, hey, use this one for headings and use this one if you have a lot of text. That we don't have guidelines like that.
Yeah, no, we do. In the Android design guidelines.
I mean, there must be baked in the themes to some extent as well, right? Do we specify different weights in different styles?
Yes.
Yeah. So to some extent, we would take care of it, at least in the standard widgets that you use.
So if you do text appearance large, you probably get a heading font. If you do text appearance medium, you probably don't.
Yeah. Text appearance. Yeah. Comic Sans. Then you get the Comic Sans. We are doing a Comic Sans version of Roboto, I hope, aren't we?
Not in the plans. I
mean, we don't talk about future development stuff,
sure.
So yeah. We won't go into the details there. But I certainly hope so. It's my favorite.
And what is it? Wingdings?
Wingdings.
Or, yeah.
Wingdings spelled with a Z. It's going to be awesome. The future is bright. So fonts in general. So that's Roboto. So what's your interest in fonts in general? Like, what do you like in a font either that you design or that you use? Like, what intrigues you about?
Well, I read a book by Knuth, and he was going on and on about the letter S. Do you have a favorite character that, you know, you study the history of? And
so I, pretty much every time that I am in a meeting or anywhere, I'm drawing letters. Sometimes if I don't have paper. Whatever is close. Like I draw the lowercase a a lot. I'm tracing it right now. Lowercase a, and then the two story G, bicameral G, is just really nice. The calligraphic version of that.
It's kind of a Google thing, though, isn't it?
Google does have a very unique bicameral G in its logo.
Bicameral, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that's it. A and G. That's what fonts are about.
Have you invented any new letters? Like a very pleasing shape that really should have a use.
There's a new letter called Christian.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I can't think of any. There's, I think, enough in the Unicode spec to keep me busy.
And then there's emojis after that. Well, so.
Yeah.
Have you done any emoji stuff? Have you branched out away from characters and into little pictures?
I have not done any picture fonts yet.
Yet.
Yeah.
Okay. No. All right, you're holding out hope when all else in your life fails. Okay. So fonts. Then the other stuff I'm aware that you dove into is some of the like layout bounds, optical bounds, regular spacing, sort of consistent guidelines.
And the whole visual rhythm.
Yes,
that was a key part of the Holo guidelines. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So you know, a lot of what we're doing is organizing really complex information, and we want to organize the information into a format that people can parse quickly. And there's a couple things that we do that makes it easier to see a whole bunch of information and I guess get it into our brains quickly. And one of those is lining things up. So if something is misaligned, it really makes you look at it whether you want to or not, that little piece is going to cause your brain to think about it a little bit.
And for some people, they'll start like actually trying to push it on the screen because it bothers them so much.
Some people might make custom builds or custom ROMs just to line things up. I don't know. I haven't done it, but actually, I haven't done things like that before. But so that's one of them. And the other one is we're actually really sensitive to rhythms. So if there are a bunch of list items, say that are almost the same size but not quite the same size, then you actually spend some cognitive cycles like trying to figure out why one is slightly bigger, why one is slightly smaller. And so we started introducing these visual rhythms, looking at the empty spaces between things so that when we did want to call somebody's attention to something, we can, you know, break that rhythm and give something more focus or something less focus by making it the same as everything else.
So the idea of a rhythm is that you can sort of imagine a grid on top of it and everything sort of falls in this cell. Is that right?
Yeah. And one of the things that you don't often think about when you're looking at, the rhythm of a screen or a page is the space in between things. Mm-hmm. So looking at, you know, what is the space above the text and what is the space below the text? Are we introducing five different empty spaces there, or can we make those the same unless one really does need to be more important, and then we can draw that distinction?
So how do you solve that? If I have like a button that's taller than a text field and they're sort of, you know, apart, like I can either try to make the rhythm of components fit a certain grid, but then I'm going to have different space between them, or should I try to make the spacing even, but then they won't be following the same, like what's the right answer?
Depends.
Oh, it depends. I hate that answer.
No, it's hard to say a general rule about that.
And this is why we have UI designers. We can't implement an algorithm to do it perfectly.
Yet.
Well.
So actually, I have a question. Since we were talking about fonts before, it occurred to me that if it's really important to line things up so that you don't get this sort of disjoint feel as you look at a page, how does serif fonts fall into that? Or is that so small that it's insignificant? Or is that one of the reasons that Roboto is sans serif? No, then you don't have these like things hanging off.
Yeah, so in every typeface there are letters that the different shapes of the letters have different optical alignment characteristics. It's the first time all week I've said optical alignment characteristics. So the really weird thing about lining type up is that what is measured to be aligned is actually different than how we perceive it. So there are some applications like Adobe's InDesign application that will have a has a feature that where you can turn on an optical optical alignment. Those are some subtleties that.
Would we notice it? I'm thinking like, you know, capital B has these honking things hanging out to the left. Would you align with those? Or is your eye more naturally drawn toward the large vertical bar? Or is it that there's a little bit of confusion over there because you're not really aligning on either one of them?
It depends. It actually depends on the scale at which you're rendering it.
Yeah.
When things are really large, the way the optical alignment works slightly differently than when things are very small. The real answer is somewhere right in between that. So it's not necessarily measured from the exact bar itself or the serif. It's right in the middle.
Okay.
It's probably an unsatisfying answer.
The answer was it depends again. Okay, so some of the visual rhythm stuff, can we call it the visual rhythm method?
Sure.
So some of the visual rhythm method stuff resulted in optical bounds, which was in,
I want to say,
MR2?
Or 17? 18?
I never know the number. I have to look in the file to see.
Well, we should probably explain what optical bounds are. So this is this thing. There's a setting you can make on recent versions of Android.
Recent.
Right.
17, possibly, maybe Jelly Bean, MR2.
I think I heard that it went in, but then there was some bug that prevents it from working in a release after it, so you're still not very safe to use it.
All right, so it's a prototype technology, which
basically lets you say, hey, for this layout hierarchy, it's not on a per-widget basis. You can set, for this hierarchy, I want you to use optical bounds. So instead of, actually, why am I explaining this? You should be explaining this. Because this is actually the first time I worked with Christian was when I was from the tool side saying, hey, in the layout editor, what do we do to make these things look better? Because it's so haphazard. These buttons that I'm dropping already have baked in 3 to 4 pixels on each side of them. Like the spacing is baked into the asset, and so I can't really align them. So what do we do about that? And then Christian said,
optical bounds. Yeah, so this is something that I was very excited about when we first got it in, because what we always want to do as designers is, as we're looking at the design systems, is make sure, again, that those negative spaces make sense. And so usually there's some kind of a logic or system behind what the spacing is doing. Unfortunately, because we had things like shadows or a glow or something on the outside of the boundary baked into the asset, a lot of times what you would see is you would want to measure just from the visible edge. So you don't want to measure from where the shadow is to measure the margins. You want to see the edge of the button itself, right? And you know, as soon as we do that, all of a sudden, the drawings that we make and we give to engineers, all of those numbers, all of a sudden make sense. And there's just 2 or 3. And in Android, we use a lot of it in an 8-dip grid or a 16-pixel grid.
Right, so just explain a little further, like if you want to have a label and a text field and you want exactly 8 pixels between that label and that text field, because that's what looks right. As a developer, how do you do that? When you don't know how many pixels are at the edge of the text field or the label, because that depends on the density of the device. It depends on you don't really know. That's the problem. You can't say, I want 8 pixels. You're going to get whatever the theme does or whatever the assets do. And that's the problem. And so, you know, sort of letting you specify exactly how many pixels are spaced between them, that's really what optical bounds is going to let you do, because it's going to know what the insets are inside those assets to where it actually appears, where the boundary should be.
Right. I mean, it's not so much that you can get those exact 8 pixels between these exact 2 things, but that optical bounds let you define what those things are, whether you're going to include the shadow artifact on the outside of the asset.
But that,
as part of that
only
spacing.
The point of that is so that you can get the spacing right. Like, knowing what they are, like, still, you as a layout manager want to be able to then subtract that so that you can say your position is exactly here, because I know that you need to be shifted 3 pixels to the left to make this spacing what I want it to be.
It makes it so that you can do, you can get the perfect spacing without having to do like negative margins.
Yes.
Or things that we always get yelled at if we suggest.
Yeah, because those negative margins are making assumptions about the theme and,
yeah,
and other things, which is not, yeah, what you want. You really want the asset itself to say, I happen to have done this.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, don't do negative margins. I've seen horrible bugs come from that. I think when our code sees negative margins, we basically don't know what to do with that information. You're in a different dimension. So don't do that. It gets close to the edge of the screen, and I don't really know what it's going to look like. So, general tip. All right, so visual rhythm. What else we got? So over in Designland, what we call UX, there's all kinds of things that go into the products that we make, specifically in Android, right? You've got, and to me, it's like, well, there's designers, but there's actually specific functions. Where do you fit? So there's visual designers, there's interaction designers, there's motion designers, there's probably performance artists over here.
Interpretive dance is a big part of our process.
As it should be.
Yeah, so there's a number of different disciplines, and of course every designer has a different kind of mix of capabilities, and we're all unique. But another one is prototypers. So so designers that are also kind of building kind of quick examples to really feel what things are going to feel like and look like before we making some of this throwaway code is actually really helpful to get, you know, figure out what the right answers are. As much as we like to pretend like we always just know what the answer is going to be, a lot of times it's hard to tell until you really start to play with it and feel it.
How often would you say that that happens, where you get a prototype and it turns out that, you know, your intuition wasn't right? I don't mean you specifically, but I mean, how often does prototype really reveal like things that you really have to change because it wasn't the way you dreamed it?
Quite often. I think a lot of one of the ways we use prototypes is for things that we know are risky or are going to be hard to define exactly, or things that won't work unless they're perfectly tuned, right? So if there's a particular gesture, you know, it could be that if it's slightly mistuned, the whole thing feels terrible. You kind of pull it into phase. You get the tuning exactly right, and it feels amazing. Mm. So those are the kind of things where you really do have to kind of play with it and push it back and forth until it feels just right.
So that's prototype, but then there's the other step of the next phase of prototyping where, okay, and then we actually implement stuff and get it running on the platform, and that's like another evaluation point, right? So how,
yeah,
often is it the case there, okay, now that the work is actually done and things are done, you know, according to the spec that people understood, it still isn't right, and you end up backing away from that?
Well, you'll know, Chet, that we never change anything.
Yeah, this is
after,
theoretical,
you know, after it's been built. You know, yeah, I think that it's again, you know, it's as much as we like to think that we can just imagine what our products are going to be like, it's not until you really start to live with them and you know, use them, even sometimes over time, that you really are able to know whether or not you've made all of the right design choices. And so there's a constant kind of back and forth between design and engineering to, you know, to get all of the all of those open questions resolved.
It's a friendly back and forth.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, always. Okay, yeah, because, I mean, sometimes you need to see it in context as well. Like, there are prototyping tools and there's design tools where you can build these things, but then they're running in a void, right? So you can sort of evaluate, yeah, the motion on, you know, this particular machine in this situation, but to actually see it in the context of, you know, a device and a particular screen size with a particular input type, whatever, that's more information that feeds into it.
Yeah. It'd
be lovely if we could do that earlier. Okay, so I was curious, what external developers should look to for design resources, especially in a reality where I think a lot of companies probably aren't set up like this particular one that we're in right now, where there's an entire team of people focused with, you know, this particular discipline. Instead, maybe the developer is actually making design choices on their own, or they're contracting it out, or they have a small design team or a person they work with. Like, what are resources that they should know well for developing Android applications? The examples would be like Roman Nurik's Asset Studio.
Yes.
Asset Studio. You can search for that and find it out there. I think it's on developer.android.com. But there's other things that we provide, like, I don't know, common icons that people want, or certainly the style guide. I'm talking a lot. I'm going to let you talk.
Yeah, so I think there's a number of really great resources on the style guide. We tried to make the style guide in a way that you could sit down and read it through from the top to the bottom and within a few hours. I would first recommend that everybody do that.
Yeah, I think not just designers, but also engineers. It's really good to have a sense of, you know, not just the style, but like what widgets you should use and what flows and everything, because being knowledgeable about that is going to, you know, make it better, even if you have a designer in-house, for you to be aware of it.
So related to, like, so there's the style guide, there's Asset Studio, there's all the stuff on developerandroid.com, books and resources. Because I've gotten this question a lot, because I've written a bunch of stuff about animation, and we can sort of show them, here's how some APIs work, here's some examples of this, we've done some look into, you know, cartoon animation and how some of those techniques could be used. And then people say, yeah, how can I get more information about design stuff? And I have no idea. I have no background in this, and I don't know where to point people to, especially engineers that want to know, you know, just enough about design to shoot themselves in the foot, right? Where would you point them at besides, well, go get an MFA?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of places that you can go to learn more about design. I think one of the biggest ones is just looking at things, and the more really great design you look at, the better sense you get. And
don't live in ugly places.
I'm
going to put that down as tip number one.
Is there some kind of pattern you see that you hate and you wish people wouldn't do? You have a kind of design pet peeve where, you know.
I have a lot of design pet peeves. Let me think. One design pet peeve is the watermark logo, where somebody can't quite figure out how to fit their brand into something, and so they say, well, let's just put it really light across the whole back of the... To me, that just
nice
it always feels like somebody couldn't quite figure it out, and so they stuck it in there.
But I like the alpha property. Let's use that.
Yeah, another one of my design pet peeves is when you have something that's red, and you know you want to use red, but red is too strong, and so you make a light red. And you have kind of this like chalky pink color that really isn't red, but you still are thinking of it as red.
There are only three colors and then white variations on those. You know that.
Yeah.
That's why they call them primary.
Yeah. Well, there's we could get lost for a long time in color theory. It's
very exciting. I did for my graduate work. I got lost,
yeah.
And then I got, you know, yeah, the hell away from it.
Yeah. And then you realize that everybody sees these things a little differently anyway.
Yeah. Is that something that you worry about in design, you know, various levels of color blindness and making sure that you don't just distinguish information by color, or like how much of a factor is accessibility in UI design?
Yeah. You know, it's actually really important. And there are a lot of considerations about contrast and which colors can contrast correctly with other colors, which colors for different types of color blindness have a different contrast profile. This is something that we talk about quite a bit. There's a number of really great apps where you can see your designs with various different color vision types. One of my more recent favorites is a camera app, actually, that you can look at stuff and
oh really
you can change the color space. Yeah,
Have we thought about using like a heads-up display infrared color scheme? Because I think that'd be cool.
I've always wanted to just to kind of, well, you always want the Geordie LaForge kind of like vision system where you can look at on different frequencies.
Except all those like comb tines would so get in the way of everything you're looking at, though.
Maybe.
We don't know until we try prototype. Yeah.
So there's the color part, and it's also, you know, for other types of accessibility, you want to be able to support really large fonts for, you know, vision impairment and things like that. And I would think that would affect layout quite a bit as well.
Yeah, this is something that I think generally in the Android ecosystem that we can do a better job of is really testing all of the apps against the different font size settings. Mm-hmm. So if you're specifying type in a list, say, specify it as SP instead of DP.
We have a lint rule for that.
Yeah. So that allows then users to choose which type sizes, which of course will change the word wrapping, and those are things that we should, you know, developers should be testing.
So yeah, the tools do a lot of this already. You've shown some cool stuff where you can show your application in different orientations and right. with different localization settings. This seems like something that. Like the tool could also provide this capability, right? To display during different in different accessibility situations.
Yes, yeah, they should do that.
Yeah, you should talk to
them. If only we knew someone on the tools team.
Yeah, so hard to get in touch with those people. I'm totally out of topics, which is unusual for me. I don't know if there's anything else in design or Android or programming that you wanted to talk about.
Wow. It's a broad topic.
Do you have any other interests, or is that really all there is?
You know, it's. I find when I go home on the weekends and work on projects, they tend to be very similar to what I'm working on here. So I feel very fortunate that I get to work on this stuff all day.
I'm kind of the same way. I actually think working on tools is fun.
It is. I'm sure it is.
Yeah, my recent project has been to on the weekends has been working on color editing and how to manipulate color spaces and
going between them or editors for different spaces.
Editors to create new custom color transforms that you can. Hmm. We did a little bit of this for the Android gallery. The various looks that you can create. So, this is one of the Android apps that I've been developing. So I can be a little bit better informed about all the things we're asking our engineers to work on.
Android app development. We'll do more of that.
It's good. I ask questions sometimes in meetings, and I think, you know, how many other developers are there that are like at my skill level, just kind of like this kind of like learning to program Android that would just like give anything to be able to ask these questions, you know? I'm like asking these things, well, what would a developer do about this? Like secretly, like this is the problem that I've been trying to figure out.
Yes. Hypothetically speaking.
Yeah. Go over to our framework engineers and like take away their time working on the framework for my little, like, I don't know how to do this little problem right here.
You save that confession for the very end of the interview.
Yeah. So, if you need development help on Android, go get a design degree and come work as a visual designer here on Android.
Have all your questions possibly answered. Do we actually answer your questions, or do we say, yeah, I don't know that one either?
Yeah, no, I can get a lot of good tips.
There's also the whole animation area, right? And so that's where you, Chet. I mean, you don't just care about implementation. I mean, you've been giving talks on all the like the various animation tricks and tips and stuff. Is that an area that you do much about in UI, sort of thinking about like transitions and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that, or I guess a fallacy that designers do when they're drawing screens is they will draw kind of all of the states But they don't draw the in-between.
Yeah, they think they're keyframes for the engineers. And we're like, okay, instant transition from zero to one.
Yeah. So what happens is you draw state one and state two, and you kind of think of them separately. And when we start to do things like, even for even in the earliest stages of a project, when you draw the first kind of major area of your app and the second major area of the app, always draw that in-between frame, like how does this state get to that state? And what happens is you start to, even for the static states, you start to do things that make more sense. You start to think, well, why did that thing that was at the very top end up something very similar or its corollary end up at the very bottom on this other screen? Does that really make sense? And it even makes, like, thinking about the animation even makes the static states better. Mm. Not to mention it makes it easier for users to understand what happened when you teleported from one place to another.
I picture that in-between state being that, was it the old Gary Larson cartoon or something where there's a caption bubble in the middle that says, then a miracle occurs.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're in the other state. Yeah, it's kind of like they're treating it like the old Disney animation model was keyframes. You get the master animator to say, this is a keyframe, and this is a keyframe, and then some junior artist would stay up all night drawing all the in-betweens. But, yeah, when the states are completely different between these different screens or even different, you know, activities, like, yeah, how is this supposed to get from here to there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the master animators kind of had an idea about what was going to happen in the in-between frames.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes you know, interaction designers, interface designers don't think about that. So I think that's the first, very first level is just thinking about that in-between frame. And then there's this whole other layer of just expressiveness and brand characteristics, where, you know, a lot of our designers are, you know, people have been working in film and motion graphics and like actually working as animators to kind of bring some of that expressiveness and story. It's kind of amazing how, you know, just the slight movement of one little element on the screen can all of a sudden just bring such personality.
Hmm. So, are you involved with any like non-visual types of user interface? So things like audio, you know, speech input, anything like that. Do we do much about that?
You know, there's a lot of really interesting things about voice input that are starting to show up in our Google Now, for example. And I, you know, experiencing this product, you know, it really does feel like that you're kind of in the next generation of products.
Yeah. So my wife has a Moto X, and it's one of those things where there's some additional value added in that phone where you can like have a dialogue with it. You know, it's like, it's saying, hey, there's a phone call from this person. Do you want to take it? And you say yes. And then, you know, it's kind of nice that you can almost treat it like an assistant as opposed to, you know,
not quite
opening up the Now app, you know, with a left swipe from the Google launcher. And
so. Yeah, there's kind of these moments where you, like, kind of like sci-fi moments where you're like, whoa, this is something new is just happened here. I felt like that the very first time that I did a voice command back on my Mac. I don't know how many years ago, you'd hold down the escape key and you know, didn't find myself using it a lot, but, you know, it seemed like, wow, this could be something new. Now it really feels like that this is something that's going to be part of the everyday usage.
Not quite to the sort of personal relationship level yet. I think we'll just leave that in movies for now, because that's just creepy.
Not ruling anything out.
Yeah, but it is strange how user interface used to be like, well, of course there's a mouse and a keyboard and everything, and now it's like, you talk to it. I mean, with Glass, you know, it's hands-free operation, yet there's this feedback that you get and you can interact with it. And it's a pretty exciting time.
It's good to be alive. I think that'll do it for today's episode. Any last words? Something really wise. We always ask the guest to say something incredibly intelligent for their last word.
I wish you had asked me that before we started talking. I could have thought about it for a minute.
All right. Well,
that's it.
That's it. Thanks.